From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. In China, the coronavirus has made a big impact already, and the effort to prevent its spread has been massive, with entire cities being shut down to contain it. Nevertheless, the number of total confirmed cases in the country has surpassed 17,000 thus far. And outside China, the virus has spread to over 20 countries, with thus far a total of 150 confirmed cases. Health experts are asking if the outbreak could peak soon, what the ultimate source of the virus was, and if there's a cure in sight. And with those questions in mind, China's global television network journalist Tian Wei spoke with one of the world's leading virus hunters who journeyed to China at the invitation of authorities to help in the effort against the novel coronavirus. This is CGTN journalist Tian Wei.
In China, the death toll is over already 360, and more than 480 people have recovered so far. The number of total confirmed cases in the country has surpassed 17,000. A big hand held out for those at the epicenter of the outbreak with the opening of the Wuhan Huoshenshan Hospital for coronavirus patients. It was built in just 9 days. Patients from Wuhan's several quarantine places are gradually being moved to the new purpose-built hospital. Outside China, the virus has spread to over 20 countries with a total of over 150 confirmed cases. Could the outbreak peak soon? Can we determine the ultimate source of the virus? Is there a cure in sight, at least in the near future? With these questions in mind, I talked to Walter Ian Lipkin, John Snow Professor of Epidemiology at the Milman School of Public Health of Columbia University. Professor Lipkin is one of the world's leading virus hunters. Recently, he came to China at the invitation of Chinese authorities to help in efforts against the novel coronavirus. What's his prognosis and prescriptions? Let's listen in. Professor Lipkin, welcome to CGTN.
Good to meet you.
Good to meet you in such a way with masks on the face. First of all, the numbers. Confirmed, suspected, deaths, as well as those being cured. The numbers are climbing. People wonder whether there is likely to be an immediate peak, Professor?
So I don't have any way to accurately predict what's going to happen. I do think that it will ultimately come under control for several reasons. One, I think that the measures that are being taken, social distancing, masks, are already beginning to have some, will begin to have some sort of an impact. We will know that when we begin to see that the trajectory slows, and that will happen before it drops. In addition, I think as we move into warmer months, transmissibility may also be affected. We know, for example, from influenza, which is another respiratory disease, is that when temperature goes up and humidity goes up, that droplets, which are normally passed from person to person or from animal to person, as the case may be, they get heavier, they travel less efficiently, and as a result, you can also see a reduction in transmission. So I'm optimistic that if we continue on the current course, that we will be able to see a reduction in the frequency of disease.
But the increasing numbers these days is more than 20% if you look at it on a daily basis, which means the number is still climbing in quite a dramatic way. As we're expecting people coming back from the so-called Spring Festival holiday, a lot of traveling as well. So another possibility of outbreak. Professor, your take?
Yes, I agree. I think that there is a huge risk associated with people returning, and that we may also see, as you said, an uptick again in these numbers. Changes in the climate, changes in the season, that will probably have an impact. And in addition, when people are no longer congregating indoors where there may be greater opportunity for transmission. And again, the social distancing, which has been, has been effective. So you can say it has not stopped all transmission, but it may have slowed it.
Professor Lipkin, help us to understand, under a health crisis such as now, how should the numbers be counted? What is the international practice, if there is any? And how is the test kits function, which you helped to came up with during SARS? And whether the test kit is the ultimate answer to any diagnosis, Professor?
Yes, it is important to have accurate numbers. This is the only way you can forecast what is going to be important, and you can estimate the burden of disease. The test kits themselves have to be very closely monitored to make sure that they perform in an accurate fashion. And whenever you have a new disease, particularly a disease that's increasing with this frequency, the demand for accurate test kits may actually outstrip your ability to build them. So what you try to do is you try to make sure that you have a kit that may not be the best for epidemiology, for figuring out how many people are getting infected and so forth, but will at least allow you to say, this is a person who is infected, this is a person we need to be worried about. So I think all of these different academicians and governmental officials are all working under very, very difficult circumstances to try to figure out what the burden of disease is and how best to respond to it. We are working with team leaders in Sun Yat-sen University and elsewhere in trying to develop test kits that will not only say this person has an infection or doesn't, but a false, your ability to say that somebody doesn't have this disorder will be greatly enhanced if you can find something else. So when somebody comes in with a respiratory infection and you don't find this coronavirus, does that mean that you missed the coronavirus because it was a problem with the test? Or does it mean that in fact they don't have that infection, they're infected with something else? So if you use an assay called a multiplex assay that simultaneously detects for other things like flu, and if you don't find the coronavirus but you find flu, then you're much more confident in the accuracy of your negative, right? So it's important that, you know, people rely on tests that they really understand. And these have to be manufactured to a very rigorous standard. So this is a challenge to do during an outbreak.
Yes, indeed. The time is the issue here, isn't it? But Professor, on the other hand, how long would it take to have it? I mean, after all the vigorous tests, as you just mentioned also.
Yeah, so I can tell you that this one, you know, we hope to have within the next 2 weeks. And the idea, and this is one reason why I think it's extremely important that scientists across the world collaborate with one another in an open and transparent way. Mm-hmm. We have to be able to get people here to work with Chinese scientists on this. They have to be free to come to the United States to work there with this on us, whether we're talking about my work or vaccine development or anything else that might pertain. And the travel restrictions are making this very, very difficult. So for example, I am leaving to return to New York on Tuesday, which is the 4th. You know, on the 4th, it's the last flights on United from Beijing to the New York area. If they move it up, then I don't know how I get home and do my work. And I run a very large team there, and I have to be there to run them. I can't do it remotely. We had planned to have 3 scientists come from Guangzhou, from Sun Yat-sen University, to train at Columbia in February. Now we can't get them in, right? So some of the things that we want to do are complicated by travel restrictions.
About the test kit, when you were doing it in SARS, you were the one contributing to the eventual coming of the test kit, and you went with your whole team making a moving lab.
Just 2 guys, me and Professor Brees. We brought 10,000 test kits.
Personally, carried.
In my pocket.
Tell me how a test kit is being developed. What is the process?
What you do is you look at the sequence of whatever it is you're trying to find, whether it's a bacterium or a virus. You look for unique sequences which you can then attach something to, right, which is called a primer. And then as you take this in the presence of something called an enzyme, which allows it to make copies, you start with one copy, which becomes two, which becomes four, eight, 16, and by the time you get to 25 or 30 cycles, you have replicated it billions and billions of times. Then you use very sensitive dyes that can bind to a specific sequence inside of whatever it is you've multiplied, and you read that, and because you have a notion from work that you've done with standardization, how that compares with the number of copies of what was present. Mm-hmm. That then tells you what was in a sample. You can do this with multiple different targets. You can do this with flu, you can do this with bacteria, you can do it with coronaviruses. It's not something that I invented, it's something that we use. The technique was originally developed by a Nobel Prize winner named Mullis, who died last year. Mm-hmm. But this is a very, very useful technique that people use. This is here in China, there's no question about that. What we will be contributing is something a little bit different. We have a special dye that increases the sensitivity, and we have some ways in which we can tweak it that we think are very, very helpful. Mm-hmm. Now, there are also efforts that we're undertaking to develop antibody tests. Mm-hmm. The point of the antibody test is that it allows you to see the history of infection. Not only what somebody's infected with now, but whether or not they've seen this or another infection in the past. The reason this is important is that I think that as we begin to use the antibody tests, we're going to find that there are people who've been exposed who developed an infection but never really manifested in such a way that they went into that official count. As we identify more and more of these people, I predict that we're going to find that the outbreak was even bigger than we know, and because it was bigger and many of these people weren't counted, the mortality rate and the morbidity rate is probably lower too. So we are probably undercounting the number of infections and probably overestimating the percent of severe disease.
All right. So this really brings us, Professor Lipkin, to another important question, is how much do we know about the virus? Now, we know possibly it is also the originally coming from bat, but there possibly is an immediate or intermediate host of the virus, but we do not know as to what exactly is it, which means this is still going on as long as we do not identify the intermediate host. And also, we do not know how it's transmitted, even though we know it could be respiratory, but only recently people noticed it could also be related to some of the other factors. So Professor Lipkin, it seems that we knew very little about this. How do you compare what we know now, the degree of it, to some of the other outbreaks, such as SARS, such as MERS, such as H1N1, H7N9, Professor?
I agree with your assessment. It came almost certainly from a bat, because the work that's been done in the Institute of Virology, where people looked at the sequences and showed that they were something like 96 plus percent similar to viruses that they'd been identified in bats, make a very good link, I think. There is almost certainly an intermediate host that amplified the virus and carried it from the bats into humans. What that host is, we don't know. One of the reasons we don't know is because in some of the markets, and particularly the Wuhan market that people think may have been important, we don't have access to the animals. We couldn't study them. We can't see whether or not they have antibodies to this virus. We can't see whether or not they had active virus shedding in, you know, at the time that they were used for meat or what have you.
But that market outbreak was much later. Many suggest that if you look at the latest reports these days, there were already much earlier cases than the outbreak happening at the market.
It's more nuanced, I think, than what than the way it's being portrayed. That doesn't mean that it could not have started at the market. It could have started at the market, resulted in human-to-human transmission, and at later date, people went back and said, aha, the whole thing starts in the market, and it started on this date, when in fact it might have started way back here, mm-hmm. right? That's what I'm saying. It started with wildlife, somehow. Maybe it was wildlife in that market, maybe it was wildlife in a different market, I don't know. But my guess would be that it started in something like that, a wildlife market, somebody came into contact with wildlife who became infected. It then amplified, right, someplace in humans, and then became better adapted, and is now spreading human to human. Now I absolutely agree, human to human transmission is the problem, and this is what we need to address.
There have been certain drugs people have been talking about, you know, whether it is Chinese medicine, which has become quite an interesting phenomenon, and people suggest, even the China CDC suggests it's this rumor that they would cure the disease. It's only, in a way, helping to fight against the disease. Well, there's a lot of nuances in the language. And then there's also a German-made medicine, which I would not even remember the name, that been circulating in the social media platform, suggesting it is very useful. And so, Professor, to you, should we grasp these opportunities, or these are, you know, unproved scientifically possibilities? At this point, when we do not have solutions, how should we face these possibilities?
So I think that we do need to grasp opportunities. We just need to do it in a way that is scientifically and ethically sound. And that means that we have to identify people who are at risk or who have disease, and we have to discuss with the appropriate experts how a test can be done of the efficacy of these drugs. If we already had some particular sort of drug that we knew worked to some extent, that would be your baseline, but we don't have anything like that. So what we really need to do is to say, we're going to test this drug versus purely supportive care. And then we have to compare the morbidity and mortality associated with those two groups of people. And it has to be designed in such a way that it's going to be statistically powerful enough so that we can get information. Mm-hmm. This is difficult. Now, everybody wants to test their own drug. And there will be people who are motivated for the right reasons, and there are people who are going to be motivated for the wrong reasons. Right. So a few years ago, as you probably remember, this movie, Contagion, that I helped
Absolutely.
That I helped put together with Scott Burns, the screenwriter, and Soderbergh. And Soderbergh. And when we designed that, we had this figure who was played by Jude Law, right, who claimed that he had discovered this miracle drug, this forsythia, which was the same thing, I think, is what you're talking about. And I'm sure there are things like this that are being pushed now, too. Mm. During SARS, people were interested in certain types of vinegar, which clearly didn't have any impact. So just because somebody is motivated, and even if they're motivated for the right reasons, that doesn't mean they're in a position to direct a clinical trial. There are people who have this expertise here in China and elsewhere who know how to design these trials in a way that will give us real answers, and that's what we need.
SARS outbreak, MERS, together with some of the others, have all been related to coronavirus. Of course, there are different types of coronavirus as we speak. Are we seeing an increasing speed of various kinds of coronavirus becoming the source of pandemic in our world today? Is that a concern to you?
If you had asked me 20 years ago, or most scientists,
I wish I could have the opportunity.
20 years ago, would the next virus that was a pandemic risk be a coronavirus? I would not have said yes. Mm-hmm. I would have predicted it was another virus. So we were surprised by SARS. We were surprised by MERS. We're not surprised by this, because we thought there was a possibility that SARS or related virus would come back. The thing that's important to realize is that these viruses are very different in the way in which they have caused you know, disruption of social fabric as well as disease. SARS had a mortality which was much, much higher than this coronavirus, even though the two of them are genetically related. MERS, which is less well genetically related to either SARS or this coronavirus, had an even higher mortality. However, this virus is spreading much more rapidly than MERS and much more rapidly than SARS. So it may ultimately cause, I think it already has possibly, when people begin to do the analysis, there have been more people infected with this virus than were infected with SARS. So when people say, is this a worse virus than this virus, it depends on how you look at it. There's less mortality.
I understand their latest practice of getting the blood of some of those who have recovered, and therefore to be able to find out more information and also to probably proceed in the way that you talk about the antibody.
So the way you do that, just so you understand the process.
Yes, please.
The first thing you do is you collect the antibodies from people who have recovered. Then you see whether or not these antibodies can neutralize the virus, prevent the virus from entering the cell, prevent the pathology that's associated with the virus getting into the cell. If it meets that first criterion, right, then it makes sense to proceed further. If you have an animal model, you can then test and see whether or not an animal infected with the virus, you can interrupt the disease process, affect the morbidity, affect the mortality. You then say, okay, we have some hints that this is likely to work, and then you can either use the passive immunotherapy, which requires collection of large amounts of plasma with immunoglobulin for people who've recovered from disease, and also proceed during the interim with building libraries of monoclonal antibodies using recombinant DNA technology, which you can then scale up and try to use. These things are very labor intensive and they take time, just like the vaccine development. But it's something that we need to do, even if we're so fortunate that the outbreak resolves. But if that happens, we should still proceed because something like this may recur.
Have something like this been built since SARS?
You mean the technology required to make such things? Yes.
The library that you just mentioned?
Yes. There are libraries that have been produced.
Here or elsewhere?
I'm not as familiar here, but the technology is something that could easily be employed here. It's not secretive. People have been making monoclonal antibodies for decades, and now there are ways in which you can do it more rapidly.
I've been talking to CEPI people, mm-hmm. Professor, which is an international organization trying to make vaccines with a concerted effort together. And they've been telling me that it could be possible to use the reference earlier developed related to MERS, related to SARS, in order to make the vaccines related to this disease faster. Now, have you seen evidence that this could be of much reference for what is going on right now, Professor?
So I think that I like the model of CEPI. It's an extremely powerful concept. And the people involved with that are first class. So I think that this idea was what I was alluding to, is to use what we know about the previous experiences with these other viruses,
right,
to make decisions about how to proceed with this one. And I'm optimistic that it may be possible to do this, particularly with newer vaccine technologies. You could extend that same model and say the drugs that have activity against earlier coronaviruses will probably have activity against this one too, because they have a similar strategy for taking over the machinery of the cell and for making more of themselves.
You were, though, infected last time during SARS.
I don't intend to get infected this time.
So you have more experience than most of the people, particularly for the first responders, how better to protect themselves. Professor, your take?
How to protect yourself. Very difficult to know what to do.
I know.
We don't yet know, for example, how long this virus will exist on the surface. But there are some things we do know. Wash your hands frequently, not with alcohol, but with soap and water. Just simple soap and water is all you really need. Don't touch your face. We make this point in the movie, too, right?
But we touch our face several times, as
yes,
you
we
also
do.
Indicate
well,
in the movie.
Yes, we do, but we try not to do that. So, instead of this,
we do this.
We do this.
Yes, indeed.
Okay, so we can do things like that. Air kisses for people who like to kiss, that's fine.
To you, sir.
Perfect. That's fine. Okay. Then with respect to the face mask, clearly when you're in a very crowded place, this is something which is important.
But in the U.S., we have specific cases suggesting using something called remdesivir to the patient. It could work for the first recovery case. Of course, it's only the first case, and nobody's saying it's a scientific.
I have so many examples where people will tell me with what we call an N of one that this worked. Maybe the person would have improved without it, maybe not. That's why you have to have these things which are called control trials, which is where, you know, you set the trial up in such a way that at the end of the process, you have an unequivocal answer. You know what's real and what's not. So I'm hopeful that one of these drugs that people are using will in fact prove to be effective and useful and something that can be produced. We just need to see.
What have you been discussing with Professor Zhong Nanshan? I saw the photos you have with him. Obviously, you are having quite a thorough discussion. You've been accompanying him on his way to the airport and also in the airport.
It was the only chance I had to see him because he's running very, very fast from place to place. Now, we talked about his perspectives, my perspectives, and ways in which we could work together to promote health and prevent this from causing more damage than it already has.
Are the perspectives very different?
No, they're not different. I will tell you that I have every confidence that he thinks very, very clearly and that he is a humanist.
WHO has declared a fake, which is a emergency of public health issues these days, and that means there are certain things that countries could apply in terms of their borders, their air traffic, their people-to-people interaction with China, or with at least Hubei province. What's your take about this decision? Some say it's double-edged.
It's very difficult for me to know what's in someone's heart. But I do know that the WHO Director General is somebody who doesn't take decisions lightly, and that he is surrounded by people who have been working in this field for decades, who are well aware of the implications of these kinds of decisions. This is why it was not taken lightly, and the decision was only made after certain kinds of data came out. Now, if people abuse these kinds of decisions to pursue things that, you know, are beyond what he intended, there's nothing that I can or anybody else can do about that. But I do understand that it was a difficult decision to make, and that it was only made because it was a feeling that this had to be done to protect the people of the world. You should understand that WHO has really no power to enforce anything. What they try to do is make their very best recommendations, and it is very inconvenient, for example, for me personally, you know, when I go back to the United States to go through the quarantine and everything else that is probably going to be imposed. But I have to work in this world, like you have to work in this world, and all we can do is the best good that we can do, and that is my focus, and that's why I'm here.
I do not want to mention politics. Unfortunately, though, we do not only have a public health crisis going on, we also have a geopolitics crisis going on. So, Professor, are you concerned as a scientist that you are putting so much effort in helping China or the other countries in fighting against this disease? Are you going to be the most welcome person when you go back home?
So I am very concerned globally about xenophobia. I cannot control any of that. I am not a politician. All I can do is try to make bridges between people and provide the very best advice that I have, and to do my research and to try to communicate with the public, which is what we're trying to do here. So, and you know, we have, you know, I have many friends who have been persecuted for various things, whether they're Rohingya or they're black or the this or the that. The fact of the matter is it's one human race. And I don't care whether you're American or Chinese, but we need to get as much information as we can about one another so we can act in an appropriate way.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.